It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This hour, we'll check in with Noah Ovshinsky in the newsroom on the big stories in Wisconsin this week, including the latest on the state budget.
Also this hour, we'll talk to the creator of the Adulting blog about how to feel more grown up. Seems like your actual age doesn't mean much today, so how do we or our kids make the leap to becoming actual functioning adults?
And you know, even though I'm a parent, I should feel like an adult. I still don't feel quite grown up for some reason. Maybe I'll find out why coming up in 20 minutes.
Our next guest says the newsroom door is locked for people of color and the working class, and it's watering down the news we get.
Farai Chidea is a media critic and an author. Her new piece in The Nation is How to Fix Journalism's Class and Color Crisis. We've got that linked, by the way, on our Central Time Facebook page. Farai, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, you start off your piece talking about how the media is becoming resegregated. What's happening? Where are the numbers going?
Well, if you look, for example, at the newspaper industry, in recent years, the number of people of color who were laid off, because, of course, the newspaper industry is in a tough spot, was double that in terms of the rate of layoffs than for people who are white. But the main thrust of what I look at is really how even what we look at as racial issues have a lot to do with class and social mobility, because there is a tendency for us in our industry to have these endless unpaid internships. And living in New York, which I do, there's no way to live on an unpaid internship without a trust fund or 12 other jobs. And it's really eroding what was once considered a working class profession, you know, this kind of, you know, muckery of people who are coming from all sorts of different backgrounds. And that's really changed.
And those unpaid internships, is that kind of the what expected? It's the natural course of a young person's career as a journalist now?
Well, it's become natural for some companies to think of it that way, but it's not really natural. And in fact, ProPublica, the independent investigative organization, has got an intern investigation on now. If you go to, you know, their site and comb through it, you'll find that they're asking people, you know, what did you do as an internship in 2013? Were you paid? Because it's becoming a bit of a national scandal that in a country like America, which is built on the premise of hard work, that hard work is not necessarily what gets you ahead if you have to pay your way into a business. It's almost like there's a toll booth that says, okay, well, if your mom and dad can put you up for 6 months and pay, you know, $50,000 for this, then you can enter this profession. But if not, tough luck.
And has there been a mental shift in the industry over the years where maybe an internship used to be, hey, we're training our future colleagues to, hey, look, free labor?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that it's not, I don't mean to speak of it as if the intent is predatory, because I think that the news industry is deeply fiscally troubled in many places. And what's happened is that people who are trying to save their newspapers, their radio stations, their television stations, look at the food chain and say, where can we economize? But unfortunately, what it's done is really put up a barrier to access for all sorts of diverse, you know, young, budding journalists. So it's not because of ill will, but unfortunately, the ramifications of cost cutting have not fully been thought through. Once you start blocking interesting, motivated people from getting into the business because they simply can't survive, then, you know, in the long run, what's to be done for our business? We can't have this stand.
So far, we've focused on how this is hurting young journalists who can't afford to survive on an unpaid internship. Now let's think about news readers or watchers or listeners. How does it affect the news we're reading, hearing, and watching?
Well, I give an example from my own career where, you know, 20 and change years ago, I was working as an intern at Newsweek. I was paid. Of course, Newsweek no longer exists in a print edition. It was during the time of the Central Park jogger trial, and I was frankly, you know, very disappointed by the tone of the coverage, which, you know, referred to the young men who were then suspects as animals. And I brought it up, and I was really rebuffed within the newsroom because it was like, well, you know, do you think, it was essentially like asking, do you think rape is good? And it's like, of course I don't think rape is good, but I also think that a trial is a trial, and we have to look at all the different sides of it. Now we know, you know, two decades later, that the people who were convicted, those young men, were actually innocent. But as I point out, it doesn't matter whether or not they were innocent. What matters is, in a tough time, is a newsroom willing to look at its own behavior? And I was one of, you know, relatively few black people at the organization, black and Latino people. And I think a lot of people who were older and wiser than me knew that this was not a fight they wanted to pick. But I was, you know, young, you know, fairly straight out of college. And I was just like, what's going on here? But if you lack that ethnic diversity and you lack the class diversity, a lot of times what you get is a false consensus, which is like, oh, of course it's okay to portray these people in that way, because no one's really thought it through. And so, again, I don't think it's a question of malice, but if you restrict, you know, even, you know, simply by your business practices, who gets to really make decisions in the newsroom, then you'll perceive the world a certain way. And when it comes to what people read, then you get a false view of what's actually going on in America.
A big part of what we do in the media is cover the economy and cover business, financial issues, money. Not having people of working class backgrounds in the newsroom making those decisions, questioning assumptions, does that affect the news we hear and the way it's reported?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's already been a lot of critique of how it's much easier or much more common to see good journalism, or, you know, at least a high quality journalism that covers the markets, than high quality journalism that covers Main Street. And part of that is just, you know, simple cost economics, is to get feet on the street in many different neighborhoods, whether we're talking about one city, one state, or the whole nation, is expensive, you know, to get people out there. But that's how you learn whether or not, you know, people are using the money they get for food stamps to buy food, whether or not relatives are you know, shacking up with people or going to shop if they become homeless, what's happening with the mortgage crisis, and also more mundane things like, at what point does it become financially unworkable for a family to send their kids to private school if their neighborhood schools are bad? Those are all questions that are easier to answer by actually getting out there and talking to people in diverse neighborhoods and circumstances. But also when it comes to the newsroom, when people are saying, you know, all the time when we sit around at meetings and talk, we're like, oh, well, yeah, my cousin such and such happened. But if everyone comes from a relatively privileged background, then presumably most people's cousins will be doing pretty well and not facing certain problems that are endemic in America. So all I'm asking for us to do within the news industry is to really consider how the economics of media are affecting our ability to tell the story of America.
Well, in our last minute or so, what, apart from asking that question and having the conversation, what are you hoping changes in the industry that might help get more of those voices behind the scenes in the newsroom?
Well, I hope that people who are making the business decisions for newsrooms really examine things like, you know, how much of their budget goes to neighborhood reporting, how much of their budget can be put aside for paid internships for people from different backgrounds. But also, you know, journalism is evolving to be more entrepreneurial. So I think both at larger companies and among people who are entrepreneurially minded, I think we'll get some new models in the next few years that will make certain aspects of journalism less expensive to do well. But until then, we'd better soldier on and keep this profession going.
Farai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Farai Chidea. Her piece on journalism is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
In just a minute, we'll talk to Noah Ovshinsky from our newsroom. He'll drop by to fill us in on the top state news of the week. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Monday morning at 8, Joy Cardine's guest will tell us how to get rid of our lawns and replace them with cheap alternatives that are sustainable and easy to maintain.
Here's a look now at some of the latest news. The Air Force is putting a female two-star general in charge of a reorganized sexual assault prevention office. That elevates the status of a group whose previous leader was arrested last month on charges of sexual battery. The office will now be run by Major General Margaret Woodward, one of the Air Force's brightest stars. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter says the city is changing the way buildings are demolished in response to a demolition gone awry that killed 6 people and injured 13 more this week. Nutter says every active demolition site in the city is being inspected for safety. Here in Wisconsin, Wisconsin Democrats are gathering this weekend for their annual convention in Oconomowoc. Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin says fighting for good-paying jobs is a winning message and it's good policy for future elections. More than 1,000 delegates and visitors are expected in the off-year convention this weekend. You can catch up on more news coming up at 4:30.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and Wisconsin Public Radio's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky is with us to check in about the latest news here in Wisconsin. And Noah, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, it's good to be here, Veronica. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. So, Noah, I'm guessing it was a pretty busy, somewhat sleep-deprived week for the news department. Just a guess.
Yeah, to say the least. It was a very busy week for us, primarily because the Joint Finance Committee finished their work on the state budget this week.
Well, let's talk about that. What did they get done at the Capitol this week?
Well, they got done a lot, although I'd say three major things sort of stick out in my mind. They firstly voted, essentially approved the governor's plan, Governor Walker's plan to reject federal Medicaid expansion and also make some major readjustments to Badger Care. That's number one. Number two, they also took on, of course, the governor's education plan, made some tweaks of their own and passed that. And thirdly, they also voted on a pretty substantial income tax cut, which was actually double what the governor initially proposed.
Right, so it was double. Explain that a little. Why do you think they went that direction?
Well, you know, the governor was looking for an increase, or I should say a decrease in taxes of $347 million. The JFC came back and said, you know what? We'll double that. We'll do one better. And passed a total income tax cut of around $650 million. To get there, they adjusted some of the brackets. They consolidated the brackets. And pretty much most everybody in Wisconsin will be paying a bit less.
Well, now I want to talk about the voucher. That was the hot debate in the education department area this last time around with the JFC. Give me a little more detail about where that vouchers debate ended up.
Yeah, you know, from a policy perspective, Veronica, this was huge for the state of Wisconsin. It really marked a substantial shift in education policy in the state. Right now, voucher schools are allowed in Milwaukee and Racine. The Joint Finance Committee essentially said, well, let's make this statewide. And so the voucher programs will be expanded statewide. There are going to be some enrollment caps on that, but it's gone from what really is a very localized program to around the state.
And then on the other hand, in terms of student spending, that was a bit of a surprise, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually, the governor proposed no new spending for students in the public schools. But the JFC actually voted to boost funding in the next 2 years, $150 per student. So each student will see a little bit of an increase, not as much as the Democrats wanted, but certainly more than what Governor Walker asked for.
Now, as far as where the JFC left it, where does it go from here? Where does it go next?
Well, like everything they do at this point, it goes on to the Assembly and then the Senate for their votes. And then it will go on to the governor, and it will be up to the governor to decide whether to accept the budget as a whole or to issue a veto, either on one or multiple items. I would say that party leaders have said that it is their intention, it's their expectation, that no changes will be made to this budget that came out of the JFC this week.
Well, let's leave the Capitol now. You're also following a story about the city of Brokaw, which is situated near Wausau. What's going on there?
Yeah, let's leave Madison. Let's leave Milwaukee a little bit. This was an interesting story that Glenn Moberg came with just a few days ago, and it really speaks to a larger issue here in Wisconsin, which is what happens to these small towns that lose a big employer, not only lose a big employer, but also lose a big tax base. And that's essentially what happened in Brokaw, which is near Wausau. A alderman in Wausau is proposing to absorb Brokaw. Now, Brokaw is a village that had a huge employer that left. It was a paper company. About 400 jobs were lost, and also a significant amount of tax revenue. And the question becomes, well, what happens to towns like this? How do they survive without these big employers? And there are officials in Wausau who would like to absorb Brokaw.
Now, how likely does it look like for that to happen?
Well, I'm not a betting man, Veronica, but, you know, it's still unclear. I mean, I think they're still very much in the discussion phase, but I think it tells you something that they're even talking about, you know, absorbing a village like Brokaw. Of course, it's controversial. There are folks in Brokaw who don't want to become part of Wausau, frankly. Of course, there are people in Wausau who are probably against the idea. And actually, you know, they're not necessarily next to each other. And so in order to absorb Brokaw, Wausau will have to annex this sort of corridor of land between the two places. And of course, the people who live in this unincorporated area also may have an issue with it because they may not want to be absorbed by Wausau.
Okay, so we'll be standing by on that one. And your reporters, they're not just covering politics. What else are they covering this week?
Yeah, Chuck Kornbach actually covered music this week. It's been several years or maybe even a couple decades in the making. But a permanent museum exhibit honoring guitarist, as we just heard a few minutes ago, Les Paul, will open on Sunday, this weekend, in Paul's hometown of Waukesha. And Chuck Kornbach went for a look and a listen.
A long list of financial and political problems slowed the development of the new Les Paul exhibit at the Waukesha County Museum. But Paul and others raised money, other issues have been smoothed over, and 2,000 square feet of memorabilia are just about ready for public viewing. Museum President and CEO Kirsten Lee Villegas has been taking reporters on a sneak peek at the photos, displays, and recordings. Villegas says one thing that makes the Waukesha Les Paul exhibit different from a more science-based one at Discovery World in Milwaukee is an attempt to give a more complete picture of Paul. So the first stop of the tour is a recreation of a 1920s-era living room. Villegas says it's the kind of place where Paul took things apart to see how they worked.
Including the candlestick telephone, the phonograph, a player piano, and begin to understand how Les, when he looked at something, even an everyday object, he saw it differently.
Paul's early experience as a tinkerer expanded into more musical instruments, or at least experimental instruments. Back further in the exhibit are recordings of five types of Paul-designed or used guitars. Railroad tie, acoustic, the so-called log, the so-called clunker, and a Les Paul electric. Villegas waves her hand over each display, and out come the sustained notes. Paul's decades of stardom came as a result of many performances in the 1940s and 50s with his wife, Mary Ford. The Waukesha exhibit honors Ford as well. Kirsten Lee Villegas says both artists were very talented and had a great stage presence.
He plays a lick and then she replicates it. Then he plays a lick and then she replicates. And then he plays a lick and she replicates. And it's very complicated and he finally basically gives up. Because he realizes that she can play pretty much as good as he can.
The County Museum exhibit adds to a string of other Les Paul-related tourist sites in Waukesha. At Club 400, a tavern formerly owned by Paul's father and brother, current owner Dan Pokwinski is happy the museum exhibit is about to open. He says he wishes it would have started up before Paul's death in 2009. But Pokwinski says maybe the exhibit will teach other people about Paul the way Pokwinski learned 30 years ago.
All the old-timers that would come down here and drinking and whatnot, they basically schooled me on who Les Paul was, and I got to meet him. And the first time I met him, very personable guy.
Other Waukesha sites linked to Les Paul include a parkway and Paul's burial monument at a local cemetery.
And that was WPR's Chuck Kornbach.
And Noah, thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
That was Noah Evshinsky. He's our assistant news director. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, not everyone feels like an adult all the time. Now, if you're waiting for yourself or your kids to grow up already, Our next guest is here to help. Kelly Williams Brown had a job, an apartment, a 401k, but she still felt like a fake adult. So she started a blog about how to act like a grown-up, even if you don't feel like one, which turned into the book Adulting, How to Become a Grown-Up in 468 Easy-ish Steps. And she joins us now to talk about how to become a card-carrying adult. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So let's talk about the term adulting. What does it mean?
Absolutely. So I have a tendency of taking nouns and turning them into verbs. And, you know, really, the conclusion that I came to about being a grown-up is that it's not something that happens for you one time. You reach a point of accomplishment, and then congratulations, you're an adult forever. It strikes me more as something that you do, as choices that you make throughout the day. And they're not big, massive, you know, forgive yourself style choices, although those too. It's more choices like wiping up that thing that just spilled rather than letting it crust and waiting for a week and a half until your next designated spill wipe-up time.
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of small choices involved. But on the other hand, you know, there's a serious side to this, too. There's been a lot of press lately about, you know, say, millennials and boomerang kids who move home again after college and live off their parents. Do you think it's kind of harder today hitting that adult milestone than it used to be?
You know, it's an interesting question, and one that I don't know that I can authoritatively answer. I mean, I've only ever been a millennial. I imagine that growing up, you know, during World War II or the Depression had its own fair share of challenges. I think it is a little bit of a tougher time. I mean, obviously the economy is not very good. People face enormous student loans. But no matter what time you're growing up in, it's never an elegant, easy process to go from being a child to being an adult. So I just wanted to address that in the book.
Was there a moment where you felt like you really were an adult?
You know, when I graduated college, I had studied journalism, and I was a reporter for years and years. And I remember when my first day of work, I had my little skirt suit on. I was living by myself the first time. And I really thought, okay, this is it. There's no arguing that I am not an adult at this point. But on the inside, I still felt kind of like a sham and a fraud. And I mean, honestly,
and I think we're going to leave it there. We're going to have to head off to news, but we'll get the rest of your story when we come back. Talking to Kelly Williams Brown, the author of Adulting, about what it actually means to be a grown-up. And we want to hear from you. What advice do you have about how to become a grown-up? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to our first ever pilot broadcast of Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our discussion about what it means to be an adult with reporter Kelly Williams Brown. She's the author of the book Adulting, How to Become a Grown-Up in 468 Easy-ish Steps. And we're taking your calls now. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Kelly, you were in the middle of your story about when you knew you were kind of an adult.
Right. Well, I mean, as I was saying, you know, there's a moment when you think, okay, the world thinks of me as an adult, and yet me personally, at least, I have yet to think I am an adult. And the conclusion I came to, of course, is that probably everyone feels that way. I would be interviewing someone for the book, you know, someone who was in his 50s, who was a successful financial planner, who had a lovely and happy family, and he would say, well, I don't know if you want to talk to me. I mean, I don't know if I'm really an adult. And I would say, no, I think you're pretty much the definition of an adult. You know, but the point being that none of us ever feel within ourselves that capability.
Well, you give some coping mechanisms, too, in your book, and one of the first ones is acknowledge that you're not special. Why is that important?
You know, it's really hard. I mean, obviously, when you're a young person, you interact with your parents and your teachers, and they adore you, and they think you are just tops. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to go on to a university, you know, you probably have the support of your professors, you have the support of your friends, and it's really easy to begin to think of yourself as being very special and wonderful, which, of course, in a way, we're all special and wonderful, which means that really none of us are that special and wonderful, right? And, you know, once you get out of college, all of a sudden it can be a little bit of a slap to the face when you realize, wow, I am surrounded by people who do not care about me at all. And this sort of accepting that non-specialness to me has two major benefits. One, it makes you appreciate all the more the people who actually do care about you. But two, it just reminds you, it gives you a reason to sort of get out there and give the world a reason to care about you and give the world a reason to respect you. And really the only way to do that is to, you know, do something that's useful for other people.
Let's take a phone call now. We have Lindsay on the line from Appleton. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, we do have an open phone line at 1-800-642-1234. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi.
Well, do you know when you became an adult?
I don't think I can say I've become an adult. I'm just really at a point in my life where I feel like I can recognize the process happening, because I don't think it's a process that ever just stops completely, personally. But one thing that I've been realizing is the ability to be able to critically think about myself and question my decisions and question why, you know, what my influences are, why am I doing certain things. And there's a lot of situations where you just kind of don't think about them, and that was just societally normal behaviors. But the ability to be able to question, well, why is this the way it is, really lets you look into yourself more and get to know yourself, because it's really important, just besides in terms of being an adult, just knowing yourself is a really important step in that process, I believe.
So is that part of what you'd suggest, then, is really just getting to know yourself and questioning stuff, figuring out who you are?
You know, honestly, most of the steps in my book tend to be pretty practical, down-to-earth things, like this is how you actually disinfect a counter, this is what you say in a condolence note. But at the beginning of the book, I do have kind of a short section about just attitude and outlook, and I think Lindsay's absolutely right. You know, a lot of times when something bad happens to us, we kind of rush to figure out why it's not our fault, you know, which, of course, some bad things that happen totally aren't our fault, but those aren't the things that you're going to learn from. Like, the situations that you're going to learn from is where you can pinpoint, okay, I did X. I definitely should have done Y. When I encounter this again, I'm going to do Y. And so being able to kind of see the natural consequences in your life, you know, whether they're big or whether they're just really small. I spent all my money on an expensive pair of shoes, and now I have no money to go out, so I will have to stay here and clean my kitchen instead. I mean, that's definitely a part of it.
Well, Kelly, give us some of those practical steps that you just might not know, because no one ever taught you or you never picked up the slack like you should have. What are some practical things that you should know to be an adult?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it really runs the gamut, you know, and something that may feel really obvious to you could be a complete revelation to me. You know, throughout the process of writing this book, people would say, well, this probably sounds really obvious, but, and then they would say something that in retrospect did indeed seem obvious, but no one had ever said to me before. You know, an example I mentioned earlier, I was talking to a family friend who just always has this beautiful, lovely home, and she said, you know, while I'm, like, brushing my teeth in the morning, if I accidentally get some little flecks of toothpaste on, you know, the counter or whatever, I just go ahead and wipe it up right then. And my brain exploded, which is so embarrassing. You know, it's so embarrassing that someone had to tell a 27-year-old, like, hey, go ahead and wipe up those little spills right now. But it wasn't obvious to me. You know, I think a lot of times when it comes to harder situations that you're comforting a friend or a family member in, it's easy to forget that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, if you're consoling someone who is in grief, you can't make them feel better. You know, really the best thing you can do is just be there for them, say, I'm so sorry, give them the space to talk, and to remember that people's needs may be very different than your own when it comes to coping with any kind of difficult situation. Also, send thank you notes all the time.
So thank you notes are not a thing of the past? We should still send thank you notes. Not email notes, thank you notes.
Thank you notes. It's really not going to take you that long. And, I mean, it's really because it's kind of fallen out of favor that they do have such an impact. But everyone in the world wants to be acknowledged, right? Like, everyone enjoys hearing that someone else appreciates what they've done. And so to take out a card and say, you know, dear Veronica, it was such a pleasure to get to know you and to be a part of your pilot episode. You know, I've long been such a fan of NPR, and getting to participate felt really special. Thank you so much. And just, you know, slapping a stamp on it and sending it to you, that actually tells you that I appreciate, you know, the opportunity you gave me. Plus,
see, I feel a lot better just hearing you say that stuff. You didn't even have to send the note. But now I feel guilty because I completely blew off the thank you notes for one of my kids' last birthday parties because I guess I'm not an adult yet. But I will. I will do better. I want to take another phone call now. Let's go to Valerie in Appleton. Hi, Valerie.
Hi.
Hey.
You know, I was thinking in this day and age of email correspondence, we have choices of how to respond to emails. You know, my grandsons will do things with a knee-jerk response. And every time you get an email that perhaps is a little bit prickly, you have a choice of how to word that email, how to respond to it with a knee-jerk reaction or with deliberate thought so as not to hurt someone's feelings or come across too crass. And so I think being an adult is someone who gives some deliberate thought to how they respond to a certain challenge. You know, when I look at something and I think, why did they respond to it that way? You have choices of how to reply and how to respond. And I often read and think, now, why did they choose that way to respond to it? Because it was a knee-jerk response. So I think an adult means that you take some time to give that some thought.
Yeah, that's a good one, Valerie. Thank you. And what do you think about that one, Kelly?
Oh, I absolutely agree with Valerie. I mean, you know, one of the challenges of communicating, you know, in large part, in most part, over the Internet, is that we lack so many of, you know, the visual clues, the voice tone, the body language that we get when we're talking to someone in person or over the phone. And, you know, in the absence of those clues, a lot of times we can really jump to the wrong conclusion about what this person is saying and what they mean. And, you know, I mean, at least personally, there has never been a time in my life when I'm about to send an angry email and I think, you know what, I'm going to wait on this overnight. I have never once regretted that decision. You know, because, and I mean, on a larger scale, when you're dealing with someone who's confrontational, you know, if someone has hurt your feelings, hurting their feelings will not, in turn, unhurt your feelings. The only thing that's going to happen is that you're just going to become, you know, decreasingly likely to actually get anywhere. So, I mean, I think there's always something to be said for just if you get an email and you think, wow, where did this come from? This is out of left field. Rather than angrily replying, to just send them an email and ask them what they meant by it.
So basic things like that, taking time to consider. And that brings to mind, you know, all the college graduates let loose into the world this, you know, a few weeks ago. Is there anything that you would want to tell them about how to comport themselves like adults as they enter the workforce, hopefully?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, of course, entering the workforce has any number of, you know, differing expectations. I mean, if you're going to work, you know, at a white shoe law firm, that is a very different prospect than going to work as a park ranger. So leaving aside the, you know, specifics of whatever your job may be, my two pieces of advice would be, one, you know, we all sit around all day inside our own heads, and we remember, you know, that dreadful thing that happened in seventh grade gym class, and we know, you know, how puffy my face gets when I cry. But people outside of you don't see those things. All they see is what you're conveying at this very moment in terms of your words and your action and your appearance. And the funny thing that I've found is, particularly when I'm feeling really lost or out of my element, if I can say, okay, I'm upset right now, but I'm just going to act calm and I'm going to act responsibly, then in the process, you know, even though I may be kind of, quote, faking it, I am actually acting calm and capable and responsible. So that's the first thing, is just remember that even if you don't feel brave, you can still act brave. The second thing I would say to anyone who's entering any workforce is, you know, you don't need to bowl everyone over on day one with your personality. I think it's a great idea, whenever you're walking into a new environment, there's all sorts of stuff going on that you don't understand. You don't know if people eat lunch at their desk. You don't know if it's a really gossipy workplace. You don't know if this is a place where everyone chatters all the time or if it's a very, like, head-down-to-the-computer kind of place. So it's really okay for the first month, 2 months, 3 months, year that you're there, to just kind of pay attention to what other people are doing. You're walking into a culture that you don't understand, and you can use your powers of observation to begin to figure it out.
Well, Kelly, lots of great stuff to go off there. Thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, we did have some calls we didn't get to. We'd love to hear your thoughts, you know, on our Central Time Facebook page. Might help some other people out as well. So happy to have your voice show up there.
That was Kelly Williams Brown, author of Adulting and creator of AdultingBlog.com, which we've shared on the Central Time Facebook page and on Twitter. Now, some beer trivia for you. Did you know that hops, a major ingredient of beer, of course, is related to cannabis, the main ingredient in marijuana? Next up, we're going to talk to the author of 20 Things You Didn't Know About Beer in this month's Discover magazine. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday at 3, it's At Issue with John Munson. John will talk to author David Grotto about healthy summer foods. That's coming up Monday at 3 on At Issue.
Here's a check of the latest headlines. As President Barack Obama sees it, the government surveillance programs that have been disclosed in recent days strike, quote, the right balance between security and civil liberties as the U.S. fights terrorism. Speaking in California, Obama said that there can't be 100% security and also 100% privacy. And he says, we're going to have to make some choices as a society. Senator Rand Paul has introduced legislation that would require a warrant before any government agency could search the phone records of Americans. Paul says the bill introduced today is intended to stop the NSA from spying on U.S. citizens. The Kentucky Republican and Tea Party favorite has been highly critical of President Barack Obama over protecting civil liberties. University of Wisconsin System Regents have approved a proposal that could eventually lead to pay raises for all system employees. The proposal involves asking that UW system employees be included in any salary hikes given to all state employees. And the regents are requesting that the UW system be given autonomy to provide further salary increases from its own resources. And you'll hear more news at 5 o'clock. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm going to turn to beer now. Part of the appeal of beer these days is you can really nerd out about it. Well, that's part of the appeal to me anyway, even though I don't drink as much as I used to.
And, you know, even if you don't drink a lot of beer, you'll be interested in 20 things you didn't know about beer. That's the Discover magazine feature we're talking about next. It talks about the health benefits, the history, and the secrets of foam.
Christian Millman wrote the piece. He knows his beer. Christian, thanks for joining us today.
Not at all. Happy Friday, you guys.
Happy Friday to you. Now, I got to ask you, is writing about beer just a nice way to combine business with pleasure?
Well, it is, and it's a good way to end a long work week.
I think we're agreeing with you right now.
Good.
Well, Christian, tell us, what is the most interesting thing that you personally learned on this assignment?
Well, it actually didn't make it into the story, but I liked some of the impact of that beer has had on language. For example, mind your P's and Q's. That actually came from old English pubs where customers who got unruly were told to mind their own pints and quarts.
Uh-huh.
Mind your P's and Q's. But, you know, that's just the writer nerd in me. You folks might have some more striking things that you want to talk about.
Well, one of the things you talked about, I am not a bearded individual, but you learned something very weird about bearded men in the UK and beer.
Actually, that was originally attributed to some research done at Guinness, the famous Irish brewery, and they found that a surprising amount of beer ended up in the beards, and I suppose like women who drink beer. And I actually got in touch with the folks, the new owners of Guinness, and they weren't able to actually track that down to the original study that they did, but they said, yeah, that if you have a beard and you drink beard, a good bit of it ends up in your beard. And they actually had a number attached to that as well, which of course you folks have seen already.
I'm trying to figure out how they'd study that. I'm imagining some scientists going into pubs with a beaker and squeezing guys' beards.
It's a tough way to make a living, for sure. But yeah, I mean, just in that one estimate, it was over 92,000 liters of beer, or divide that by, or divide that by four if you want a gallon number.
I'm guessing if that much beer is going into your beard, you've probably been drinking for a while. Just a guess. Well, I don't know.
Just a guess, but Great Britain actually lags the U.S. even in per capita beer consumption.
Really?
They don't drink as much as we think they do. They just act like it.
Well, you know, on a more serious front about beer, we all want to believe, but is beer actually good for your health or not?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a really cool fact that I came across is that all 13 minerals necessary for human life actually exist in beer. Plus, it has a ton of the so-called antioxidants. Getting back to Guinness for a second, malt or roasted malts like those used in Guinness are particularly high in those antioxidants. So, yes. Beer is absolutely a healthy drink in moderation. Of course, beyond moderation, you end up with things like beer bellies, which are, in fact, proven to be a cause of excess beer consumption.
Uh-huh. So,
sorry to rain on your parade.
So as long as you do it in moderation, that's the message about everything these days.
Right.
Be moderate.
And moderation is 2 to 3 per day.
Then you also share a secret of foam. What does the foam tell us about whether we're drinking a good beer or not?
You're talking about Brussels lace, or otherwise known as Belgium lace. It's speaking of nerdy things, it's one of those things where there's some dispute among beer nerds. Beer nudes, I couldn't address.
Less said, the better.
Yeah. But basically what it is that it's thought to be an indicator of a high-quality beer if it's foam, if its foamy head sticks to the side of your glass as you're drinking. Others just say it looks pretty. I don't personally have an opinion on it. It's nice to look at.
It's a pretty word anyway, Brussels lace. I like
Brussels
it.
Brussels lace,
yeah.
Doesn't
seem very beer-like.
No.
Well, what about the history of beer? What did you dig up there?
It is actually the source of the oldest known recipe that historians and archaeologists could find. It dates back to ancient Sumeria, where it was actually sung as a hymn. The recipe was sung as a hymn because people were mostly illiterate then. So what better way to begin your hymnals than with a recipe for beer?
Wait, there were beer hymns?
Absolutely.
I want to hear one.
You can't make this stuff up.
Can you sing one, Christian? I want to hear a beer hymn.
I know a few limericks. I don't know if that'll be.
Well, one of the things I thought was most interesting, a scientist studied ants under the influence of beer. What can
John
we learn
Lubbock.
About ants drinking beer?
John Lubbock was a groovy dude. He was a naturalist, quite a famous one in the 1800s, and he did a really cool book called Ants, Bees, and Wasps. And I'm pretty sure that's the first time cool book and three insects have been noted in the same sentence, but it was a really cool book. And he found that drunken ants, he got them drunk on beer, and left them there drunk. He called them insensible in his delicate way. Their friends actually found them, picked them up, and carried them back to the nest to sleep it off. Drunken strangers, however, were thrown in a ditch full of water, which has some parallels to human behavior, of course. But it was interesting that the sober friends weren't actually judgment-free about their drunken fellows. He actually noted this interesting point. He said the sober ants seem somewhat puzzled at finding their intoxicated fellows in such a disgraceful condition. And they took them up and carried them about for a time in a somewhat aimless manner. And I have this lovely vision of ants with their fellows on their shoulders spinning in circles. And to me, it was probably just an early version of a swirly.
Christian, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your beer facts.
It was my pleasure.
You can check out Christian Millman's Discover Magazine article, 20 Things You Didn't Know About Beer, on the Central Time Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening to our debut program, and now let us know what you think.
Send us your thoughts about the new show and your suggestions. You can email listener@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our producers are Chris Molina, Amanda Magnus, and Galen Druk. Michelle Good is our board operator with engineering help from Joe Hartke.
Cheryl Gasser is our executive producer, headlines editor Kristen Durst. Thanks also to program director Mike Arnold. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening.